This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we'll speak with the Reverend Jim Wallace. He's a well-known evangelical leader. He's known for stepping into the political fray on issues he cares about. So we'll ask him why he chose to step out of the spotlight during last year's presidential campaign. That's later in the program. But first, we want to turn to presidential politics in Venezuela. Voters there are selecting a successor to President Hugo Chavez this weekend. You probably remember that Chavez died of cancer last month. The election is being watched far beyond that country's borders, though, because of some of the policies Chavez implemented about the country's most valuable resource, oil. Chavez shared the wealth with the Venezuelan people and also with his Caribbean and Latin American neighbors. But whether the country's next president can or will continue those policies is another question. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called NPR's Tom Gelton, who's been following the situation there. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
So we understand that Chavez had designated Vice President Nicolas Maduro as his successor. Is that about, am I phrasing it correctly?
Oh, there is no question that Nicolas Maduro was Hugo Chavez's choice. He made it very clear. He was, as you say, his vice president. And while Chavez was sick, he was actually made the acting president by the powers that be in Venezuela because they knew that Chavez wanted him to succeed him.
And why did he want him to succeed him?
Because he was loyal, because he believed in the Chavista vision, because Chavez felt that this was the man that could carry on the program, the ideology, the alliances that Chavez believed in. For example, Maduro is very close to the government in Cuba, and that alliance between Venezuela and Cuba was very close to Chavez. Probably there was no one else in the leadership, in the political leadership in Venezuela, that was more closely aligned with Cuba, aside from Hugo Chavez, than Nicolas Maduro.
So I think the question is, can he carry on these policies? I mean, one thing that a lot of people are talking about is that Maduro lacks Chavez's charisma. So just kind of as a leader, he doesn't have one of Chavez's kind of essential qualities. But there are other issues beyond that. Could you talk more about that?
Well, I think the big thing is that the environment in Venezuela has changed a lot, and it would have been even a challenge for Chavez to maintain his popularity, which was phenomenal. I mean, he was really a very popular man. He defeated soundly Enrique Capriles, the main opposition candidate in Venezuela in elections just last October, almost without campaigning because he was already sick himself. But Venezuela is facing just a series of really serious economic problems. Inflation, we don't know how much inflation is. It's well above 20% inflation. Also, for various reasons, even though Venezuela is, as you said before, a rich country, there are shortages of food. There are shortages of all kinds of basic items. There are long lines, and that's obviously something that the Venezuelan people get very upset about. Crime is a terrific problem. So just generally, the quality of life in Venezuela has really deteriorated. And so, as you say, Maduro has to confront a much more difficult situation than Chavez dealt with during most of his 14 years without Chavez's charisma.
But and it's also true that one of Chavez's main sort of policy tools, the oil prices or the oil wealth, is also in flux right now, isn't it, too? I understand that oil production is going down, even though oil prices remain high. Why is that?
Well, oil is by far the most important, really the only source of revenue for Venezuela as a country. I mean, this is 90% of its export earnings. The problem is that all of that oil wealth that Chavez, you know, for political reasons, for ideological reasons, wanted to share that wealth with the people. But that's not the way to really ensure the future of your oil industry. Any oil industry requires a lot of reinvestment. You've got to maintain your fields. You've got to continue exploration. You've got to invest in new technology. You've got to maintain your drilling infrastructure. You need the technology and the expertise that foreign oil companies represent. And instead of promoting that kind of reinvestment, and instead of inviting in the foreign expertise that Venezuela needed, Chavez diverted a lot of that wealth to social programs. You have ridiculously low gasoline prices in Caracas. We've heard from NPR's Steve Inskeep, who's been visiting Venezuela this week, that gas is 20 cents a gallon or less in Caracas. That is not a productive use of your oil wealth. And as you said before, he's been sharing this oil at discounted prices with his neighbors. So instead of reinvesting that money into, at least a portion of it, into the oil industry. He's been diverting it in other places, and that means that oil production is going down. I mean, in 2012, Michelle, the country earned $1 billion less from oil than it earned in 2011, and already in the first quarter of this year, oil production has gone down by 7%.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with NPR's Tom Gelton. We're talking about Venezuela's presidential elections this weekend. We're also talking about what it could mean for the country's oil diplomacy. Well, among the countries with which Venezuela has shared its oil is the United States. I mean, I think many people will remember some of these ads that have run in certain markets around the country where it's subtle, but it is made clear that Venezuela is making oil available to low-income people at steep discount or for free. But that's just, I assume that that's just for mainly for ideological reasons.
Well, he was very clever politically. And, you know, the United States was making it very clear that U.S. governments, whether it's the Bush administration or the Obama administration, made it clear they did not like Hugo Chavez. They did not like what the direction that he was taking Venezuela in. They didn't like all the anti-U.S. rhetoric. I mean, he always talked about the empire, and North American imperialism. So they didn't like that. But Chavez found a way to stick it to the Americans by providing fuel to low-income people in the Northeast. And even here in the Washington, D.C. area, there are families that benefited from this fuel oil program. So it was very astute on his part.
Do you assume that those days are numbered of a program like that? But really, really more broadly, though, there are other countries in the region who depended, I would argue, economically on this discounted oil. Could you talk a little bit about that and what is the future of those arrangements?
Well, at the top of that list, Michelle, is Cuba, which has really Venezuela under Hugo Chavez replaced the old Soviet Union for Cuba as its main benefactor. Cuba has been getting something like 90,000 barrels of oil a day from Venezuela on steeply discounted terms, actually reselling some of that oil on the open market for hard currency, so earning money. But not only Cuba, you also had 18 countries in the so-called Petro-Caribe Alliance, the Caribbean and Latin American countries, countries like Haiti, Jamaica, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Guatemala. These are countries that are energy poor. They don't have their own sources of energy. If they have to buy energy on the world market at these high prices, that's terrible for those countries. And they were getting very discounted supplies of oil from Venezuela. And it would have been very hard for them to sustain their economies without that oil. Haiti, for example, had its entire oil debt to Venezuela forgiven after the earthquake. So it was starting from scratch. That was a very important boon to Haiti. Now, however, as you say, I mean, you can't do it all. You can't have almost free gasoline to Venezuelans. You can't spend a lot of money on social programs coming from the oil industry. You can't give oil away to people in Boston and Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and to Cuba, and to at some point when
and
oil,
reinvest in the industry. To
and
keep
reinvest
it
in the industry. When oil production is going down, at some point you have to make some choices. And who knows? Your question was, what's the future of this of these grants to people in the United States? My guess is that on the list of priorities, that's probably not very high. Maduro, if he wins, and he's probably going to win, he has to, first of all, pay attention to his own popularity at home. And I'm not sure that homeowners in Washington, D.C. sort of rank that high.
That was where I was going to go next. And for the couple of minutes that we have left, you know, I was wondering, in terms of the voters in Venezuela, the people of Venezuela, what they think about the strategy of oil diplomacy. I mean, you can imagine how, on the one hand, it would be a source of kind of national pride for people that they're able to play this role in the region and kind of boost the standing of their country in the region. On the other hand, when there are shortages of food and basic goods, as you've discussed, there's an exodus of skilled workers. Whenever people can get out, they are leaving. Do you have a sense of how the people of Venezuela, the voters, feel about the use of their oil wealth in this way?
I can't claim to have a firsthand sense of that, Michelle. We do know that Enrique Capriles, the opposition candidate, has been gaining a bit on Maduro in polls recently, and he has made it very clear in his campaign that he would curtail a lot of that diversion of oil to other countries. So apparently, I mean, if you're a Venezuelan voter and you have to choose between, cheap gasoline at a time when prices for everything else are rising and support for social programs in Venezuela, if you have to choose between those things and a government program that subsidizes consumers in Haiti or Washington, D.C. or somewhere else, you're probably going to prefer that that money stay at home.
But before we let you go, tell us just a little bit, if you would, about the opposition candidate. I mean, you've made it clear that Maduro has kind of the imprimatur of Hugo Chavez. Chavez clearly designated him as his favorite successor, and his kind of popularity has transferred to him, at least for now. But there is an opposition candidate. Could you tell us a little bit more about him?
His name is Enrique Capriles. He's a governor. He is himself a fairly charismatic figure, probably more charismatic than Maduro. And he recognizes the popularity of the Chavez program and has actually pledged to continue a lot of the priorities that the Chavez government proposed. So he is, unlike some of the opposition candidates that Venezuela has seen in the past, who just presented themselves almost as kind of right-wing versions of Chavez, Capriles seems to be much smarter politically. He's still got the tremendous disadvantage of not being the designated candidate of the machine. He has to really fight to get airtime and to get the kind of attention that Maduro, as the government candidate, is getting. But he has run a fairly effective campaign.
NPR's Tom Gelton reports on global security and economic issues. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios, our last broadcast, in fact, at our headquarters here. Tom Gelton, we'll see you on the other side.
We'll see you on the other side, Michelle.
Thanks for joining us.
Now to Florida and what was once one of the state's most popular tourist destinations.
Here at Silver Springs, Florida, is the most unusual bathing beach in the world.
Since the 1800s, steamboats, railroads, and eventually automobiles brought visitors who came for the sun, the wildlife, and the freshwater springs, at that time the largest in the world. In recent years, though, Silver Springs has lost its luster, and the springs themselves have declined, both in volume and in water quality. NPR's Greg Allen reports on efforts to restore a spring called Florida's Natural Wonder.
Even if you've never visited Silver Springs in Central Florida, you may have seen it, if you're old enough. The 60s television show Sea Hunt was filmed here, as were countless movies, including Tarzan and Creature from the Black Lagoon.
You'll see the most amazing underwater photography that the screen has ever known. In this strangest of all science fiction adventures.
Silver Springs' crystal-clear water made it invaluable to Hollywood. And as Guy Marwick, the founder of the Silver River Museum, recalls, it drew over a million visitors a year.
But it was not an amusement park in the sense of Coney Island and the rides that one might associate with it. It was kind of the natural Florida. And I think that's what people are hoping to see it go back to now.
Later this year, Florida's Park Service will take over Silver Springs and begin working to restore it to a more natural state. But that's a huge task. Over the past two decades, Silver Springs, and most springs in Florida, have fallen on hard times. Drought, development, and excessive groundwater pumping have cut the amount of water flowing here in half. From the walkway that overlooks the head spring, the water is still blue and crystal clear, with fish, turtles, and alligators clearly visible. But director of the Florida Springs Institute, Robert Knight, says, look closer and you'll see the problem. Pollution from agriculture and residential development has helped coat the spring with algae.
This spring was white on the bottom. It was a sandy bottom and shells. It was just glistening. It makes it so much brighter. Now it's green on the bottom because it's covered with algae. When you go out on a glass bottom boat, you'll see it's just not glowing at you the way it used to.
When Florida's Park Service takes over operations at Silver Springs, the rides and the reptile farm, with its two albino alligators, will be gone. But the spring's signature attraction, its famous glass-bottom boats, will remain.
I'm the oldest full-time boat captain. I've been working 44 years this month.
Glass-bottom boat captain Oscar Collins has seen big changes at Silver Springs over those 44 years. Today, just a few dozen people are in the park. A big contrast with Silver Springs' heyday in the 1960s.
We were doing 4,000 and 5,000 people in the middle of the day, and on the weekend, 6,000 and 7,000. Mm. We are moving people here.
Good afternoon, everybody. How's everyone doing today?
On the boat, we glide over the spring vents that deliver millions of gallons of water from Florida's aquifer into the Silver River. Like all springs in Florida, much less water than was produced just 10 years ago. Fish are no longer abundant, but there are some. Most of the aquatic plants are covered by algae. Nitrates in the spring water, much of it from fertilizer spread on farms and lawns, promotes the growth of algae, and Knight says eventually kills the plants.
And we lose the plants in springs. I mean, it would be tragic to lose all this vegetation in Silver Springs, but our other springs, we've already lost all the plants.
A dozen years ago, alarm over the decline of Florida springs drew the attention of political leaders in Tallahassee. Then Governor Jeb Bush launched an initiative to save the 1,000-plus springs throughout the state. That program was defunded last year by Florida's current governor, Rick Scott. But for Silver Springs, at least, the state takeover is good news. To improve the spring's water quality, Florida regulators have set targets for reducing the amount of nitrates. Hitting those targets, though, will mean addressing the sources of pollution, putting thousands of septic tanks on public sewer systems, and aggressively reducing the amount of fertilizer used by homeowners and farmers. Drew Bartlett of Florida's Department of Environmental Protection acknowledges it's a massive undertaking that could take decades.
Well, it certainly is a challenge, and you know, my response is essentially, that's not an excuse not to get started. We know where sources are.
Springs advocates are especially concerned about a potential new source of pollution just a few miles from Silver Springs. Water management officials are considering plans for a huge cattle ranch that would withdraw millions of gallons a day from the aquifer that feeds the springs. The 15 to 20,000 head of cattle would produce as much as 1 million pounds of manure a day. Here's Robert Knight of the Springs Institute.
What we're getting is very intensive farms using a lot of water, and with very big wells, and using a lot of fertilizer to maximize their profits. And that's what's hurting our springs.
In some ways, Florida's endangered springs are a symptom of a larger problem. With development and wells being sunk for everything from golf courses to bottled water plants, Florida's aquifer is being depleted. In some areas, the aquifer, which most Floridians rely on for drinking water, has dropped by 60 feet. Some coastal communities are now getting salt water in their wells, which costs millions to treat. And the most visible consequence of excessive pumping from the aquifer may be Florida's epidemic of sinkholes, including a massive one near Tampa recently that claimed a man's life. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Here is what's been happening year by year to the Columbia Glacier. It just retreats every single year.
Anyone who caught the film, An Inconvenient Truth, has seen this. The world's ice caps are melting. Most people are focused on what we're losing, but others have considered what might be gained by the disappearance of all that ice. First, let's look at what might lie beneath that ice.
The U.S. Geological Survey released a report in 2008 where they estimated that 13% of the world's remaining undiscovered oil and 30% of the remaining undiscovered natural gas could be in the Arctic.
That's reporter Amy Crawford. She wrote in this month's Smithsonian Magazine that Russia's already sent submarines deep into the Arctic Ocean looking for oil and natural gas, and China wants a piece of the action.
China obviously does not have any Arctic coastline. Their northern border is about 900 miles from the Arctic Circle, but they are seeking influence.
And that influence would come through Canada, one of their chief providers of oil. Next month, Canada will assume the chair of the Arctic Council, which you could consider the United Nations of the Arctic. So far, though, Russia has the upper hand.
Russia is hoping that the UN will recognize its claim to a very large swath of territory right up to the North Pole itself. So in 2007, they actually did this symbolic flag planting where they sent a formerly secret mini-submarine down there.
On the ocean's bottom, they planted
a flag? Down to the ocean floor, and they planted a titanium flag. So it sounds like, you know, something out of Christopher Columbus's playbook.
And here's another boon that could result from the melting ice shelf, the Northwest Passage. For centuries, explorers tried desperately to navigate that route along North America's border with the Arctic, connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Again, reporter Amy Crawford.
The Northwest Passage became navigable for the first time in the summer of 2007. Navigable doesn't mean that it's totally free of ice. There's still icebergs. It's still fairly dangerous for an ordinary ship to pass through it.
But for China, the prospect of using the Northwest Passage for exports is becoming increasingly important.
It would be about 4,000 miles shorter than the route through the Panama Canal between the Atlantic and the Pacific, so that would clearly cut travel time by weeks.
And that means the question of who owns the Northwest Passage has once again come into play.
Canada says it's an internal waterway, but the U.S. says that this is an international route. So this dispute between the U.S. and Canada could become more heated as the route melts.
And we're not done with new enterprises appearing where ice once used to be. In Siberia, there are now mammoth tusk hunters. You heard me correctly. The tusks of long-dead woolly mammoths, encased in ice and permafrost for centuries, are now being revealed. And that means bounty hunters can legally take them. Photographer Evgenia Arbugaeva grew up in a small town in Siberia and heard about the rush of local men to sell mammoth ivory.
After international ban of elephant ivory trade in 1981, mammoth tusk became a sort of a substitute for this material. So I would say from 1981, people started to really see it as a business.
Arbugaeva and writer Brooke Larimer collaborated on a story for this month's edition of National Geographic magazine about the mammoth tusk boom. One picture shows a hunter half the size of an ancient tusk. The two traveled to remote Yakutia, Russia. Larimer spent a week just getting there from Beijing to a remote landscape.
There are millions of tusks out in the tundra. Many of them are buried very deep into the ice. Some are near the surface, which is what the local hunters are finding. 90% of mammoth tusks end up in China, where they are often turned into kind of mammoth trinkets and things. Or these big pieces are carved by the master carvers in southern China and turned into objects of art that can be worth $1 or $1.5 million. And these hunters, as they go out, they're not coming back with loads and loads and loads of tusks in their boats. They can go a whole summer and find only a couple hundred pounds worth of tusk. But those tusks are so valuable. And the one that you see in the first shot, which is that amazing tusk that is arcing over more than twice the size of the tusk hunter underneath it, that is probably the finest specimen that was found last year. And that can be worth $80,000 to $100,000 or more, even at the point of sale up there in Yakutia.
And they're very fragile, right, the tusks? I mean, transporting them back has got to be difficult.
Yeah, it depends on how long they've been exposed to the air. The hunters take very good care of not to expose them. But the ones that have been out on the beaches or that they find that have been exposed often disintegrate. And that's one of their arguments for why what they do is not exploitative, because they figure that they are actually rescuing some of these specimens that would otherwise just disintegrate and be lost forever.
How do scientists feel about the tusk hunters? Are they not perhaps disturbing scientific data by taking these tusks away?
Well, there are some scientists that really lament the trade having kind of soaked up all of these tusks. Each of these tusks is kind of like a tree which has rings. The tusks themselves can carry information about the climate, the diet, and that would be valuable data. On the other hand, if they find mammoth hair or actually an intact mammoth, they're the first ones to tell the scientists.
Yeah, I hadn't known until I read your story of these Asiatic peoples, the Yakut.
There are several different indigenous peoples that live in eastern Siberia. They originally went up kind of on these sleds across the ice, which is about a 30, 40-mile crossing to the first island. Well, the ice would then melt, and they were stranded on the islands looking for the tusks until the ice would freeze over in the fall and come back. Now most of them come back in September by boat, but these are small boats and very heavy seas. And what really brought the end of the mammoths was the warming climate. It reduced their grassland habitats. It flooded it over. Some of the seas rose significantly and stranded many of these populations until they eventually went extinct. And what's happening now is that as the climate also warms, you are finding these mammoth tusks starting to emerge. And the people that are there are following the same pathways, enduring the same brutal conditions, and they're pursuing the same beast, basically, as their forebears 10,000 years ago. It's an extraordinarily difficult life, and it's probably one of the toughest occupations in the world.
That's writer Brooke Larmer. Together, he and photographer Evgenia Arbugaeva produced the article of Mammoths and Men for the April issue of National Geographic magazine.
Closer to home, a predator called the lionfish is disrupting reefs from South America all the way up to North Carolina and has even spread as far north as New York. This fish has red stripes and long feathery spikes and is rapidly eating its way through local fish species. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that researchers see no way of stopping it.
Lad Akins has been diving the vibrant reefs of the Bahamas for many years. But on a trip a couple years ago, he found almost no fish smaller than his hand.
And seeing the lack of small reef fish that used to inhabit those sites was very startling to me.
A hungry interloper called the lionfish was power-eating its way through the Caribbean. Akins co-authored a study that found that in just 2 years, reefs in the Bahamas lost on average two-thirds of their small prey fish. Larger fish that people like to eat, like red snapper, were down by more than 40%. Lionfish are now found all the way from New York to Venezuela. Akins works for the conservation group Reef. He organizes groups of divers to capture or kill lionfish. A government scientist says removing lionfish one by one may help preserve a reef here or there. Ecologist James Morris works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says there's no way to stop the whole invasion.
It's like an oil spill that keeps reproducing and will keep reproducing forever.
What makes lionfish so unstoppable is they reproduce every few days and nothing eats them because they're covered with venomous spines. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
This is NPR News.